I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hooney Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
So much of it is done either the day before, the morning of, before people even get there. So you know, people love to hang in the kitchen. You pop a cork, you have some munchies, and everything comes together really simply. And it is really truly based on the way that we cook at Avec.
There have been one or two times where I have been called in as a hired gun after a book has been sold to a publisher. So I wasn't involved in writing the proposal. And that's a little bit more of a like, okay, I'm just being parachuted in and I need to figure out who these people are stats so that we can hit the ground running.
What I tried to do is I had a fictitious character that I was always writing for who was like part my mom and part maybe a homemaker who likes to cook. I really tried to keep her in mind.
You know, when working with vegetables, you really have to consider how you're going to make them, how you're going to build flavor, and how you're going to make them into something that doesn't just seem like a side dish.
Those are the voices of Paul Kahn, Jamie Feldmar, Rob Newton, and Raquel Pelzel, chefs, authors, collaborators, and editors who all work on cookbooks. Today's guests on a special Talking Cookbooks episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. Welcome to a new show and the new year. Hope you all enjoyed the holidays and are ready to get back to it this week. I did a lot of thinking recently, some of it about this show. One of the things I resolved is that I want the introductions to be shorter and to the point, so this will be brief. Another is that I want to do much more writing this year and have more of an ongoing dialogue with our listeners. And so I've kicked things off by posting an article on Tokeland, my blog, which now lives on the Andrew Talks to Chefs website. The topic of the post is categorizing chefs for the new decade. It crystallizes some thoughts and themes that have largely emerged from conversations on this very podcast about how we'll be thinking and talking about chefs in the coming years. I'd love if you took a look, and if you think I got anything wrong or missed any categories, hit me up by email, voicemail, or on social media, and let's kick it around. Also over the holidays, it occurred to me that we're more than 2 years in on this show, and people start listening at various points in our timeline, so I wondered if I've been taking it for granted that people know who the hell I am, at least where chefs are concerned. So I won't do this every week, but just briefly, in case you're new here, I've been writing with and about chefs for about 20 years, first collaborating on cookbooks, more than 25 of them, and then memoirs, and then writing my own chef-focused books, most recently, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, about the American chefs of the 70s and 80s. That background is a convenient way into this week's show. I'm fond of saying this is a chef show, not a food show, but I'm sure many of you who listen to this podcast are readers or maybe even collectors of cookbooks. Maybe you even have aspirations of writing or being involved in the cookbook world in some way yourselves. Well, over the course of the fall, I did a few interviews with chefs and writers who had recently published cookbooks. As regular listeners know, I've been migrating away from my former host network. In fact, we're now fully independent, which took some time to finalize. And so interviews from summer and fall backed up. In the lemonade out of lemons category, it hit us that gathering several of these together would make for an interesting multi-pronged look at the world of writing and producing cookbooks, as well as an in-depth look at three books that published in the fall, all of which I like a lot. So this show has a bit more food talk than most of our episodes do, but I'm guessing that's probably going to be welcome to many of you. So on this episode, we have two returning chef guests, both of whom put out cookbooks in the fall, Chicago's Paul Kahn and former Brooklyn chef Rob Newton. We have prominent collaborator Jamie Feldmar, who's worked with chefs like Naomi Pomeroy and Angie Marr, and also collaborated on Rob's book, Seeking the South. And we have Raquel Pelzel, a cookbook author and editor who works at one of the most prestigious houses in the business and is recently out with her own new book, Umami Bomb. Taken together, I think these conversations will give you a sense of what it's like to write a cookbook, what the business of cookbooks is like, and also give you a sense of three compelling books that came out just recently. I had hoped to share this before the holidays as a sort of gift guide, but maybe if you have some Amazon gift cards laying around, you can treat yourselves to one or more of the books we discuss in the new year. Okay, with that, here's our first conversation with returning guest Paul Kahan, first interviewed here way back on episode 5 of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Paul is one of Chicago's most prominent and prolific chefs and restaurateurs. His second book, Cooking for Good Times, written with Perry Hendricks and Rachel Holtzman, is a deceptively simple book that's meant for home cooks, but is unmistakably chef-like in its thinking. We explain all of that in our conversation. Here you go. All right, so let's talk about this book, Cooking for Good Times. You wrote this book with Perry Hendricks.
Yeah, the chef
who's your chef at Evec.
Yeah, for maybe 6 years now.
Wow.
Perry was a huge contributor to the book.
And your collaborator was the writer Rachel Holtzman. Your first book was the Publican book.
Yeah.
Cheers to the Publican.
Yeah.
And this book, I mean, it's interesting to me because I feel like it's called Cooking for Good Times. Super delicious, super simple. Even with that title, it's probably even more simple than one might expect from a chef.
Thank God. That was purely the goal. I mean, the Publican cookbook was based on the idea that we were going to follow product, you know, through this incredible supply chain that we created with mm-hmm. that restaurant group, you know, a butcher shop, an organic bakery, the restaurant. And it's complicated. You know, we wanted to do it through the vendor's eyes.
Yeah.
But the food appears very simple on the plate there, but as we sort of peel back the layers of the onion, people see that it's more complicated. You know, we do a ton of charcuterie at our butcher shop, which is never easy. Bread baking is never easy. There's a lot of, you know, parts to the recipes in the Publican book and a lot of recipes that are simple,
mm-hmm.
but I think the whole thing, you know, some of the ingredients, some of the sourcing can just be a little bit overwhelming. So this is really the anti-Publican book was the mm-hmm. idea, and it's really based on sort of the joy of cooking for friends and entertaining and partying.
Yes.
And it was just a ploy to get me up to my cabin in the North Woods to shoot a lot of the book.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah,
fish.
Yeah, there's some shots of you. I was going to say glamour shots, but they're not glamour shots. You're like in shorts and a t-shirt, like sitting on a wood staircase that I assume probably goes down to a dock or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But to me, it both feels like the anti-chef book, but then also feels like the quintessential chef book. And
cool.
I mean is,
you're not just saying that, are you?
I'm not just saying that. I went through this thought process and reckoning with the book as I looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I mean is, I mean, these recipes could not be more simple. Here, I'll just rattle off. So some of the chapters, make some food to eat while you cook. And the whole premise is people are going to be hanging if you're entertaining in your kitchen.
Credit for that goes to Gabrielle Hamilton.
Oh, really?
She just got that in my brain. We were doing a dinner together, and she just, I don't know what she said, but she's like, yeah, people love to eat in the kitchen. They love to. And the idea for the book is people come over to your house. Everything's done the day before. Mostly
this
everything's
is a book
done
about
the day
hanging,
before.
How to hang
it
and
is.
Eat and cook at the same time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's that. Then add some cured meats and grilled sausage. Buy some greens. Roast some roots. Toss together some old bread. That's like a panzanella section.
And more,
but a lot of panzanella. I mean, you get the idea. Melt some cheese.
That's a raclette chapter, which is revolutionary.
Roast a whole fish. Where you give detailed instructions, including photographic.
Yep.
Roast a yard bird. These are just some of them. But my point is, those are not necessarily chapters, and these are not necessarily recipes in terms of how simple they are
mm-hmm.
that one would expect in a chef cookbook. But this is how chefs eat at home.
Yep.
This is how chefs eat after service. If you look at where – I've always said this. Even somebody who operates at the forefront of molecular or modernist, whatever you want to call it, gastronomy.
Is that still around?
I think
just teasing.
Modernist
teasing.
People. Say, well, you're from Chicago. You can't say that.
I know.
You guys are, if it's
I'm
anywhere, well, you tell me. If it's anywhere, it's in Chicago. Even people who operate in that realm, this is how they eat after service. Nobody's going out looking for spherical, you know, olives or whatever after a long day in a kitchen. This is how cooks eat. So to me, it's not necessarily what you would expect a chef to write, but it is, I think, how chefs eat. And it's, you know, these recipes, you know, they're not like you get into the panzanellas, for example, and it's not the same panzanella you're going to find in 20 Tuscan cookbooks. This is, you know, it's informed by your
very experienced, very sophisticated palate. Does that seem like a fair assessment of the book?
It does. We're trying to give people a roadmap. You know, those sweeping chapter headings are based on a technique.
Yes.
You know, believe it or not, you don't just toast the bread. We do more. You know, we melt butter and olive oil together with herbs de Provence and toss the torn up pieces of bread with the crust in that and then bake it in the oven. And that to me is so delicious. Like I gorge on that stuff when it's sitting on the sheet tray cooling in the kitchen. But then it gives you the opportunity to do it with things that are in season, things that you could get at any market, just about anything. So it gives you a real simple plan to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the idea is so much of it is done either the day before, the morning of, before people even get there. So you know, people love to hang in the kitchen, you pop a cork, you have some munchies and everything comes together really simply. And it is really truly based on the way that we cook at Avec, our second restaurant in Chicago. Yeah. And you know, the story is in the book of how the first time that I ever went to Europe. You know, it's a long story, but my wife was in this motorcycle accident before I met her. Anyways, we got picked up in whatever the big city is in Switzerland. I'm blanking on it right now. 2 hours up into the Alps, and our friend Verena lives in a 400-year-old farmhouse that they've meticulously redone. There's a hearth in the kitchen, and we sat around a big table.
Yeah.
We cooked food for probably 10 hours. I was delirious, jet lagged. We drank our heads off. You know, they have a wine cellar, bottle after bottle from their travels around Europe. And it was just a hang, and it was delicious food. It was like, wow, this seems like an idea for a restaurant. And that was a lot that went into Avec. So.
Yeah. Well, you tell that story in the book. You also have these principles that you lay out, can we talk about these?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you say it's dedicated to the few truths I've discovered about cooking, and then you add especially at home. You're going to be most successful if you have a small repertoire of can't-miss dishes and small changes you can make to them.
Yeah, so, it's like learn how to roast a chicken really well. You know, the recipe in the book is, I think it was Joel Robuchon's grandmother's chicken. I saw a recipe probably in the New York Times 100 years ago and worked on it. And
that was your foundation.
That was my foundation, and I worked on it and made it my own. You know, it's trussing the bird. It's, you know, stuffing half of an onion and a carrot and a half a head of garlic. And then it's cutting up chunks of lemon, putting that in. Usually I like to do it in a glass or a ceramic pan.
Yeah.
But you don't have to. But I chunk up a lemon and I put the rest of the head of garlic in the pan and I put a little water in there and I rub it with a lot of butter. Whatever. I've worked on the recipe for many years, and you end up with this incredible juice in the bottom of the pan, and you end up with a really moist chicken. And you know, we fussed. The original recipe was like start on the breast, flip it on its side, flip it on its side, you know, all this mishigas. And at the end, it's just like put the bird in the frickin' pan and cook it.
Well, what's interesting to me, but also what you say about this small repertoire is, you know, I think we've gone through this evolution with books, right? With chef books, because, you know, 20 years ago, and this is when I was coming up as a collaborator, so I was part of the, you know, I'm guilty, right? I contributed to this. But there were all these chef books were basically, to varying degrees of success, you were literally conveying how people could recreate these actual restaurant dishes.
Remember the Charlie Trotter books?
Well, the Charlie Trotter books. I did Alfred Portale's books. The first Gotham book was very much in that vein.
Tall Food, yeah.
Of course, the don't let him hear you say that. Of course.
Sorry, Alfred. Nothing but respect.
I mean, the French Laundry cookbook is probably the one I think that straddled the fence most successfully.
It did.
Because, you know, the production values and everything else equivalent to the books Charlie was doing, but you know, doable if you really wanted to go to that trouble, you could do it.
There's true building blocks of cuisine in that book.
Yes, and these little essays about, you know, very simple concepts and almost a philosophy, right?
Big time.
But you know, I think what people realized over the last couple of decades is most people don't want to cook like that at home. They actually want to cook like this.
I don't want to eat that way, to be honest.
And so those books, I think, you know, for chefs, great. For cooks coming up, inspirational, sure.
Yep.
Souvenir of a restaurant, absolutely. You're a foodie, you want to know how the magic tricks are done, yes.
Yep. It's a really small percentage of people, though.
But you want to hang it home. So my point is, this thing you say here, which is so basic, right?
Yeah.
But there was this notion, I think, for years that people, and I think there were people who actually ruined a lot of their own dinner parties trying to be like this because they never came out of the kitchen, you know, is that you wanted to try these, like, you know, it's almost like stunt cooking. But this notion, a repertoire of can't-miss dishes, yes.
Yeah, the Avec pork shoulder, is something that we developed in the very beginning, and it's so absolutely delicious, and you could put so many different things with it. You could put clams with it. You could put kielbasa with it, you know, and on and on and on. And that technique is in the book. It's not hard. It's delicious. It could sit for a week in the refrigerator, and you heat it up in a cast iron pot or in a pot in the oven, and it's just mind-meltingly delicious.
Yeah.
And we have suggestions as to how to serve it. You could tear it up and crisp it up in a Teflon pan if you want, and it's delicious, and put a fried egg on top.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, but and that's honestly the way that I cook at home. You know, my wife and I have a very simple repertoire of stuff. It's fast. You know, there's a little lemon mayonnaise in the fridge, or a little grabiche, or this or that, and you adorn it with something that's really simple that you have on hand. You know, chop up some pickles and whatever. But that's the way we cook. And it's tasty. It makes you feel good, too, after you eat it.
Awesome. You want to make as much as possible in advance. Every cook knows that, right?
The more
you do ahead, the more opportunity there is for having a good time.
Simple principles of life.
Yes.
Yeah.
You don't... Yes, the martyr host is not a... That's not a desirable effect.
You never want to be at that party where the host is trying to impress and they're just... The wheels are coming off the car as it's going on.
Yeah.
It's a horrible feeling.
Yes. This I loved. There's no order food needs to be served in, and no set menu you need to create or follow. One dish plus a beautiful green salad is absolutely a meal.
Yeah, how about it? I mean, you know, great roast chicken and a delicious green salad. I mean, why do you need to push it further? I don't get it.
Yeah,
If you have the opportunity to go to the farmer's market and get these, you know, beautiful greens and maybe some vegetables, you know, some haricot vert that you throw in the salad raw, shave some raw beets in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, and we address all this stuff in the book. I think people just overthink. Just put it in your mouth and taste it. You know, like put the raw, you know, shave the raw beet with a peeler and taste it. And if it's sweet, it'll be great in the salad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I don't want to waste my time with shenanigans.
Right. Okay. Again, this to me was so refreshing because this is how I am with wine. There's no particular kind of wine you need to serve, even though I'll point you in the right direction because a little extra thought is only going to make things that much better.
I go to the first statement about the small repertoire.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to go to almost always rosé because it works with just about everything, dry rosé, bubbly. Good bubbly works with, you know, especially for me, French champagne works with, I mean, I've done champagne dinners, Krug, where we did Krug champagne, both aged and fresh with the entire meal. And it's spectacular. But, you know, I like lighter reds. I like Gamay, you know, with a little chill on it or not. You know, I'm not a big extracted wine guy. I mean, there's, you know, if you're eating a big steak, sometimes it's nice to have, for me, I go like to the Rhone and then I kind of dig my heels in the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, a really well-crafted American Cabernet can be incredible. People are going to hate me, but, I just go with the things that I'm comfortable with. And I cross over. I mean, chilled Gamay works great with white flesh fish, if you ask me, depending on what you serve it with. And if it's not perfect, who gives a crap?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's more, you know, I hark back to an interview that I heard Alice Waters give many years ago. My wife actually recorded it for me and gave the tape to me. She put the tape on at Christmas time at the house as a trick. And I was like, this is on the radio? I'm so in love with Alice Waters and everything she stands for. And she was saying it's more about, and this is a defining principle of my cooking career, it's more about the person that you're sitting across the table with, and it's more the experience of breaking bread and sharing that experience and that food being a vehicle to have a great time with whoever you're with.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to got to take a picture of everything that's on the plate, got, you know, everything's on there with, you know, the 30 components are on there with the tweezers. And I know I sound like a hater. There's a lot of incredibly talented chefs that use tweezers and do intricate food, and it's amazing. It's just not who I am. It's not what I'm about.
There's a place for all of this.
Absolutely.
A place for all of this. This is something I've done for years, and I love that you say this. Your food can absolutely go straight from the oven to a trivet on the table, let it sit for a few minutes while you relax, then eat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People get too hyped up about everything being hot, and I just like I've had dinners. I think of in particular about this one farm that these farmers we love, Dave and Susan Cleverd, and their farm is called Kinnikinnick Farm outside of Chicago, and they have this beautiful farmhouse that they built for people to enjoy. you know, they built the farm for chefs and friends and wine people to come and just experience this gorgeous farm. And the way that I ate at their table, actually, I think I was there on one of the failed attempts to write a cookbook, but they just, you know, cooked a beautiful ribeye and let it rest and sliced it and put great arugula on top and shaved some Parmigiano Reggiano and olive oil and just let it sit there. And we drank our wine and we relaxed. And it's just the more informal, the better.
It was a disappointment and then a revelation to me when I first started getting to know people who do what you do for a living. And once in a while, I'd get invited to their apartment or their weekend place or something. And initially, and this was my own naivete, right? I thought, well, they're going to cook these outlandish meals, you know? And it was like, you actually have this in your book. One time it was, you know, brandade. Mm-hmm. Many times it's roast chicken.
Many times.
Pork shoulder. I mean, it's a roast. Mm-hmm. It's a casserole. It's a great pasta and a salad. As often as not, the little you're smiling as I say this. Well, the little snacks are like, you know, anchovies and some great bread and butter. And that's it.
I'm smiling because I'm thinking about, you know, like I said, a lot of this was inspired by the way we cook up at our lake house up north. And I don't know if it's because, you know, our house is kind of slightly architecturally significant and it feels very Danish and Japanese to me. And so I've started to do Japanese food at the house up there. It's like my hobby when I go up on my fishing trips or my wife and I spend time. And I do like hot pot cooking in danabes and it's super easy. It's like you kind of like just have all the right ingredients, you throw everything in there, you put the lid on it, and you could put that thick clay danabe on the table and just let it sit there, and it simmers away, and you drink sake or whatever, you know, whatever you care to drink. Yeah. But it's sort of the new simple for me is this really peasant-y country Japanese cooking, and I love it. It's really fun.
Do you find that your food, you know, your food's always been fairly straightforward. I'll call it that. That's fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you feel like it's gotten even more simple as you get older, as you mature as a cook? Do you feel like it's even gotten more stripped away, more elemental?
100%.
Yeah.
I think it's partly a function of age. I think when you get older, you just don't want to eat. I mean, me in particular, I've sort of I'm much healthier than I was 10 years ago. I feel better. My energy level's higher. I think more clearly. And I think a lot of it is just eating clean food. I mean, I still, believe me, when I walk through a kitchen and there's a sheet tray of you know, bacon that just came out of the oven, I'm going to grab a piece. I'm not giving up all those things that I love. But eating clean and simple really makes me feel good. And I think human beings' stomachs can't process. I mean, certain people's can. Mine cannot process a lot of different things, like a big, you know, 12 or 14 course meal. Yeah. I feel like I'm in hell, especially the next day. It's just too much.
I think the last time you were on, you talked about you don't go on these 2 or 3 dinner, you know, tours anymore. Right. I mean, any cook who's listening to this knows what that is. That I can still, if I plan, if I know it's coming, I can do a big tasting dinner.
Sure.
You know, if I'm going out of town a couple of days in a row, that gets to be a bit much. If there's a lot of alcohol, that gets to be a bit much.
It does.
But the thing that still amazes me, and I, even guys, you know, your age and older, I know a lot of cooks who will still go into a town and do like 2-3 dinners in one night, and that I can't do.
No.
That's over. I just can't. I wish I could. I have the interest. I understand it, especially if you're, you know, if you're there for a day or two and you want to try as much as you can.
Absolutely.
And I don't believe in ordering crazy and just tasting because the waste just kills me.
I'm not just being
PC, but like I can't just take a couple bites of stuff. First of all, the food itself and then the work that went into it and the fact that they're going to see it maybe go by.
I would agree.
I can't.
I've been with somebody that actually ordered with a group of 6 people, ordered the whole menu.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to try everything. And it was just I was like, what? Are you crazy? I'm not going to say who it is. I think Heidi knows who it is over there. Anyways, I'm so excited that you went right to those sort of defining principles because that's really what the book's all about.
It. Is there anything in particular in this book that you were especially pumped to share? Something that either is sort of a favorite of yours from an eating standpoint or that you feel like you mentioned raclette. That's something you don't see in many books, at least here.
Yeah.
But were there certain things that you were especially a technique, a recipe, a thought, you know, that you were particularly excited to share with, you know, with home cooks?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, there's a lot of things that I'm excited to share with home cooks. But I go to the root vegetable section, which might sound peculiar. But I've been, I mean, number one, I'm a gardener, and I grow a lot of root vegetables. I grow like 3 or 4 different kinds of beets, and I grow turnips, and I grow et cetera, carrots, rutabagas. And I love to eat them, and they're, I think they're oft misunderstood. And, you know, the way that we cook them in the book, we sort of have this general technique where you peel some of the skin off, and if the skin's tough, you peel the whole thing, and if it's not tough, you leave it on and you wash it, and you cut it in the right size chunks based on the density of the vegetable, which is really easy to figure out. And then you roast it in a hot pan. And like people think about, people know boiled beets, they know roasted beets, which are really delicious. But when the skin is thin, or even when you peel the skin and you chunk them and you roast them in a a pan in oil, hot, and you just coax the flavor out of them. Like, I feel like all roots have a little bitterness to them. When you coax the sweetness out of them with a little bit of honey or a little bit of sugar, put the pan in the oven to let them finish roasting, they get a little caramelized. I think it's one of the most delicious things in the world. And I kind of pride myself on, like, I'll see a cook doing this technique that I've done so much in the kitchens over the years, and I'll be like, no, that's not how you do it. Which I'm not that guy a whole lot. But at any rate, the opportunity to, you know, pair roasted beets with grilled radicchio, or you know, marinated Tuscan kale, or just a whole plethora of things. Really, it's delicious food, and it's super tasty. Like, there's a beet recipe in the book. Beets are roasted that way. We marinate Tuscan kale just from raw. And I know it's all the rage, but we marinate it with garlic and chili flakes and lemon zest and lemon juice and even a little bit of Parmesan or Pecorino, just a good hard cheese, and just massage the crap out of it. But then we take both those things, and those are done. They're in the fridge. And we char them in a black steel pan before we serve them. We dump them over burrata, and we drizzle hazelnut vinaigrette on it. And everything that I just said right there, really, like roasted vegetables, charring, like almost blackening them on a griddle or in a cast iron pan. I mean, you don't have to. You could put them over burrata or stracciatella or nothing. But then that nutty vinaigrette, you know, has been like a eureka for me. Like, nut oils are really exciting to me. I've, you know, nut oils with oysters, nut oils with wild mushrooms, nut oils with root vegetables, just really, really complex, delicious flavors. You know, the better the nut oil, the better the flavor. So I don't know that, I don't know if that sounds exciting or not.
No, that's the kind of thing.
But I think it's really cool.
Well, that's the kind of thing to me with a cookbook. You know, other people have said this. If you get like one, it's how I feel about doing interviews for a big project. If you get one great quote, you know, it was worth the time. Most cookbooks, if you get one great recipe out of it or one great technique, it was worth buying the book, right? But this, I feel like this is, that's what this whole, I'm not just saying this because we're talking, but that's what this whole book is these like great, you know, like you say, adaptable, reusable, I don't know what the right word for this would be, but things you're not going to tire on. These are things that, you know, people have been cooking and eating at home in some version for a long time with your spin, you know, and you mentioned this technique for the for root vegetables. And like you said, if the recipes are simple enough that, okay, you don't want it as charred, maybe as you don't have to.
Don't char.
But the house of cards isn't going to collapse if somebody takes that one out.
Correct.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And like I said, they're great cold. They're great at room temperature. They're great warm. So yeah, I'm very proud of the book.
Well, it was great to see you. Thanks for squeezing me into your visit. The book is Cooking for Good Times by Paul Kahn with Perry Hendricks and Rachel Holtzman. It is out. It's available anywhere you could buy a cookbook.
Awesome.
And I suggest you buy it. Thanks for coming in, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Again, that was Chicago's Paul Kahn, author with Perry Hendricks and Rachel Holtzman of Cooking for Good Times. Our next guest is somebody who, to be honest, reminds me of myself as a young writer. Jamie Feldmahr is a talented, well, I shouldn't say reminds me of myself if I'm saying talented, but anyway, too late now. Motivated journalist who started collaborating on cookbooks, mostly with chefs, a few years ago, and has come out of the gate strong. She worked with Portland, Oregon's Naomi Pomeroy on Taste and Technique, with New York City's Angie Marr on Butcher and Beast, with New Orleans chef Justin DeVillier, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, Justin, if not, my apologies, on the New Orleans Kitchen, and with Rob Newton, who you'll be hearing from later in the show, on Seeking the South. Jamie used to live in New York and recently located to Los Angeles. She and I met up outdoors in Union Square Park, the site of several interviews we've recently posted on the show. And we talked about what the collaborating role and relationship is like, how it fits into the life of a writer, and what the unique rewards and challenges of it are.
Here you go.
People always ask me how I got into this, and they ask me how I got into this, and then they ask when I'm going to do my own cookbook. And the reality is that I will never, I don't want to say never, but I will almost certainly never do my own cookbook. Yep. Because my background is as a journalist. I am a reporter who reports and writes about food. I'm not a recipe developer. I like cooking at home, mm-hmm. but I have never worked in a test kitchen. I don't want to. I often hire a recipe tester for the books I'm co-authoring because I don't want to deal with it. It's a job unto itself.
Yeah.
So, you know, my background is when people ask what I do, I say I'm a journalist. And this whole co-authorship thing sort of fell into my lap when a chef that I was friends with through writing something about her wanted to do a cookbook and asked me to do it with her. And that was where that was Naomi Pomeroy, mm-hmm. who has Beast in Portland, Oregon. And that's sort of how this all began. And so I like co-authoring because it's like doing a long form assignment on someone and really getting into their psychology and getting into their voice and hearing what makes them tick. And I do hope that to write my own book someday, but it will not be a cookbook. It might not even be about food.
Well, can we say this? I mean, this is the case for me because I used to get asked that all the time. Mm-hmm. I never did a cookbook. I actually sold one once, and when the moment came to start working on it, I was like, I don't want to.
What was it about?
It was a great idea. It was called the Weekend Warrior Cookbook. I can say it was a great idea because it wasn't my idea. I had a friend in the film business who had spent a weekend with us, and I'd been cooking a lot over the week. This one we used to have a weekend place. I'd been cooking a lot. And on the drive back, he said, we got to come up with a concept for you. And in the car, from the back seat, he goes, I got it. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, this is when there was a ton, there still are these books, but it was really starting to break all these like 30-minute meals and 5 ingredients or less, or da 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 da. And his idea was, that's how people cook Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. But this is counter-programming. This is for the hobbyist chef. This is like terrines and, you know.
The weekend project.
Big project cooking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, where you might order things ahead of time or special order thing. Yeah. And I was like, well, A, I didn't want to do it. And B, I was like, you know, to really make that work, I'm going to have to become this person known as the weekend. I'm going to have to be a buffoon. You know, like, that's what I thought. And I didn't want to even try to do that. And the other thing was, and I'm wondering if this is true for you, this is the question I was going to ask you, is I don't particularly have a culinary point of view. I don't express myself through food.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I express myself through words. And
yes.
I write primarily about food, but not exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my first job was at Gothamist as an arts and entertainment reporter. When I was a kid, you know, I wanted to be a film critic. That was my dream job. And that's not really my dream job anymore. But when I think about the types of things that I like writing about, food is one of them. But mm-hmm. it's really more about what's going on inside of people's heads.
What's the collaborative process like for you as you do it now? Heavily interview based? How do you go about it?
You know, in the beginning, I always tell chefs, it's different for every chef, right? Because sometimes, you know, with Rob, for example, we'd been friends for years before we decided to work together.
Right.
And we're still friends.
Yeah.
And I'm not just saying that.
Right. You mean you're still friends even though you just went through this
yes.
sometimes
we
emotional...
We worked together
yes.
and came out the other side.
Yes, that's a good thing.
But someone like Angie, I didn't really have a personal relationship with before we started working together.
Yep.
I had profiled her for The Village Voice, RIP. She liked what I wrote and was looking for a co-author. So that's how that started. And in the beginning, you know, I sort of told her, we're going to have to mind meld a little bit. We just have to hang out. We are just going to need to spend some time together because I don't really know you. And if I'm going to be writing in the first person as you, I need to have a sense of your voice and your tone and the way you talk and the way you think. So in the beginning, I think it's just a lot of hanging out. And I try to have it be relatively agenda free. You know, especially I've done a lot of long distance collaborations. Mm-hmm. I've worked with chefs who don't live in the same city as me. So there's some travel involved. So maybe we have a weekend together, 3 or 4 days together. And so then it's like, okay, can I come to your house? Can we just have a meal together. Yeah. Maybe we'll go to a bookstore. We go look at other cookbooks that are out there so that I can start to get a sense of, you know, what they pick up off the shelf, what they're drawn to. It's not a super scientific process. You know, I don't sit there and tape record every single conversation we've ever had.
Right, you don't have like a punch list of things you're going to, like, of...
Not this really.
This is my punch list of activities, well, bonding activities.
Okay, so here's the other
thing. Although I do the bookstore thing as well.
So here's like a little bit more behind the scenes is that it depends when I come into a project. More often than not, I have written the proposal to sell the book and then I stay on to do the book. Mm-hmm. But there have been one or two times where I have been called in as a hired gun after a book has been sold to a publisher. So I wasn't involved in writing the proposal. And that's a little bit more of a like, okay, I'm just being parachuted in and I need to figure out who these people are stats so that we can hit the ground running. But when I'm working with a chef from the beginning, which is sort of my, you know, there's pros and cons to both. The pro to working with a chef from the beginning and developing the proposal with them is that you do spend a lot of time, or at least I spend a lot of time, just sort of talking, shooting the shit, feeling out what exactly they want to do. Why do they want to do a book? What do they care about? You know, really evolving those ideas. I'm a structure freak. So I like organizing. You know, I was a managing editor for years. I keep track of things in my mind, and I like it when they fit into place.
Can you tell people what a managing editor is?
A managing editor is the person who keeps, at a magazine or a website or a newspaper, who keeps all the trains running, keeps track of all the deadlines, mm-hmm. Usually is the one wrangling freelancers and just sort of setting the daily editorial schedule of whatever publication. So I am a little bit OCD in that way, and I like making things that feel nebulous and loose feel tangible and like they have a place.
I'm struck by all, you know, we don't know each other that well. Mm-hmm. We get along.
Yeah.
We've hung out a few times, mm-hmm. not many, probably less than a handful, mm-hmm. but I'm struck by these similarities because first of all, I was the film critic of my high school and college newspaper. Mm-hmm. Second of all, I refer to myself when I have meetings with prospective collaborators, I call myself a structuralist.
Uh-huh.
And I tell them that I'm all about structure.
It's very satisfying, right? When
it's like the same thing
to make it fit.
Yeah, I used to write screenplays, and screenplays are all about, they're not supposed to feel this way when you watch them.
Huh, but maybe now that I'm in LA, I should be a...
You should be a screen... Hey, you know what? Everybody else is...
The only way to make money as a writer these days.
No, but, you know, the idea of when you learn about screenwriting, which I tried to be one for a few years, mm-hmm. and I studied it and wrote some screenplays. But, you know, literally in that world, some people do it this way. You know, you come up with all the things that need to happen, all the information that needs to be conveyed, mm-hmm. and then you have an index card for each scene, mm-hmm. or some people do it this way. And you write on that index card, this is what, you know, we're going to find a way through the dialogue or the action or what we see. We're going to convey this information. This is what we're going to learn about the mm-hmm. character. Da, da, mm-hmm. da. And then when you actually go about writing the script, that's almost the least creative part of the whole thing, right? And cookbooks are kind of like that.
A proposal is similar. You know, by the time you write a proposal, the idea is that you're outlining the whole book in graphic detail so that by the time you have to go write the book, it shouldn't be that hard, theoretically.
Right. Because you have a roadmap.
You have a roadmap, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the pro of coming in and doing the proposal is that you get time to really feel that out, and in that process tend to get to know the chef a lot better, just almost as a, you know, as a byproduct of that.
Mm-hmm.
The con of that from a business perspective is in the finances, and I don't know, you know, I'm happy to get as into this as you want or not. I think it's important to be transparent with this kind of stuff. But, you know, as a co-author, I will get a modest proposal fee. It's not much. And then it's really, you know, my payment is, it depends on how much the book sells for. It depends what the advance is.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes it might take 6 months to write a proposal. So I'm essentially working almost on spec for 6 months until we sell this thing. And you never know how much it's going to sell for, obviously.
Yes. And on spec, people should know. That's a term I know from the film. I think that mm-hmm. comes from the film world.
It might.
But it basically means speculative. It means you're writing without payment. You get a... Proposal fees are usually a couple thousand bucks,
yeah.
and so relative to the time you spend,
which is dozens of hours, might be more than 100 mm-hmm. hours of mm-hmm. time and writing time, interview time, hangout mm-hmm. time, writing time, research time. Mm-hmm. It's no way, you don't make money on a proposal.
Yeah, no, absolutely
not. The work that you can't be doing during that time would pay exponentially more money. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's the pro con. The flip side of it is getting dropped into a project and needing to figure it out ASAP, and that can be fun in its own right.
Yeah. And the upside of that is...
And the upside of that is that you get paid ASAP also.
Yes, right. Yeah.
So...
Yeah, like right away.
Yeah.
What's your main criteria when you're approached about a job and whether or not you want it?
There's a couple things. I'm picky about the chefs that I work with because I think that I understand the big picture. A cookbook is a part of a marketing toolbox, and I think everyone gets that. But I want to make sure that whoever I'm working with actually wants to write a book for the right reasons.
Which
because,
are?
In my opinion, a chef should actually have something to say. Mm-hmm. They should have some wisdom that they're trying to impart, whether it's about a culinary, you know, whether it's culinary technique based, whether it's a worldview or a point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, like I'll just to make this a little more real, Naomi Pomeroy, her book is all about teaching home cooks how to level up their culinary ability at home. Uh-huh. The book is literally called Taste and Technique. It's very technique driven. And that was really her MO. She really wanted to teach home cooks how to get better. Angie, for example, her book is much more about capturing a mood, an atmosphere, a restaurant, a place and time. And it's less about, you know, teaching home cooks how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not, it's not like one's better than the other, but I just think that a chef has to be really invested in wanting to do this. Mm-hmm. And they have to be genuine and they actually have to have something to say because it is, am I allowed to curse?
On this show?
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you the same thing I tell everyone, you can, and then anyone whoever's ever asked, then they get they do the one curse and then that's it.
Okay.
But yes, knock yourself out.
Well, it's a shit ton of work doing a cookbook. And you don't really make a lot of money off of it, especially as a chef.
Yeah.
And it takes a long time. So it has to be something that you really want to do.
Yes.
So I try to screen for that because there are some chefs who are doing a cookbook because their publicist told them that they should have a cookbook.
Yeah.
You know, or it's a concept that they're not really invested in and they just want it to sell well.
Yeah. Well, I remember years ago working with someone and their agent referred to the book as the product. And I was like, oh, my God.
I just rolled my eyes for all of the listeners out there.
But I was
there.
Like, oh, my God, what have I gotten into?
So that's sort of step one in terms of what I look for when I'm considering a book. But there's also a business component as well. I have been approached about many books with chefs that I really like, who have ideas that I really like, who realistically are not at a level where they are going to sell a book for enough money to make it make sense for me to come onto the project.
Yeah.
And that's the less heartfelt side of it, but this is a business, and especially if you're going to bring in a co-author, you know, no one really does cookbooks to make money, but you need to be able to pay your people, and in order to do that, ideally you're a chef who's, you know, you have to garner a big enough advance. So you probably have to have gotten a certain amount of national press, awards, a big enough audience, whether that's from TV or social media or any other channel, to convince a publisher to give you a big enough paycheck to hire me. So I have unfortunately, you know, on a personal level, there have been books that I've wanted very badly to do where the numbers just don't make sense.
Mm-hmm. And even the ones that seem to make sense until you get the offer, you actually publishing is so fragile right now. There's no, you and I have the same agent.
Yeah.
Our agency will not, what do you think this will sell for? They will not answer that question.
They will never answer that question.
That is a forbidden question to answer in that agency mm-hmm. because no, they don't know.
From a financial perspective, working on these three cookbooks made up maybe 60 to 70% of my annual income. And there was another 30 to 40% of freelance, editorial work, copywriting, whatever other random things a freelance writer does to make a living. You know, books are not the only thing that I work on.
Sure.
And they can't be. I can't afford for them to be.
Yes.
Well, also, you, as someone who, I mean, again, you're not someone who's trying to kind of work your way up to doing your own cookbook. You, like you said, you're mm-hmm. you're started as a like a generalist, I guess. You know, just a journalist. Mm-hmm. That would be really unsatisfying to just do the collaborating. Although I do think the, you know, working, trying to get somebody down, getting to know them to the point where you can write it in voice, I do find kind of a fascinating.
It is fascinating.
Exercise.
That part is the most fascinating part. The actual, you know, I think people sometimes forget that 80% of a cookbook is recipes, usually. And writing recipes is pretty formulaic. There's only so much linguistic finesse you can incorporate yes. into a recipe, you know, yeah. like, and especially when you're working with a publisher, they have a house style and they give you this whole list of rules to follow about how they want their recipes to look.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can try to have fun with the head notes and with the intros, but let's be real, a cookbook is mostly about the recipes, and most readers don't even read the head notes. So.
Yeah, well, I had an editor once who referred to the head notes as the blah blah. So
yeah,
she
the
called
blah,
me
blah.
Up and said, not so much with the blah blah.
Yeah. So I think for me to be satisfied as a writer, I need to also work on other things.
Yeah. What about the production of something like a photo shoot? Do you get involved in that?
Depends if I'm sharing in the expenses or not. but generally, yes, whether financially or just emotionally.
I meant more like logistically. Like, do you help plan them? Do you sit in on, you know, the pre-production meetings with like the photographer and the prop stylist and the...
It's case by case. I think best case scenario, you hire a photographer who sort of has it under control. I like to be there during the photo shoot and to just... You know, photo shoots are long days, and yeah. I think it's important to keep morale up and to make sure everyone's getting fed and to make sure that, you know, if there's any discrepancies between what you actually wrote and how the dish is looking when they're photographing it.
How you wrote the recipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens. That's a mistake.
That's like a quality control thing.
That happens a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Mistakes.
So it's good to be there. It's good to have someone there who's intimately familiar with the text.
Right.
But in terms of planning, you know, the day-to-day shot list, I let the photographer handle that because that's their job.
All right, you have a...
Do I have to go?
You have a scandalously early dinner date.
Yeah, another eye roll.
It's close by, though.
Yes.
Okay.
well, Andrew, thank you so much for having me on
much.
Your podcast. I hope that this was illuminating for your listeners. But in all seriousness, I would say that the cookbook co-writing industry world is very small and very mysterious to people who have never done it before.
Yes.
You know, I met Andrew when I was basically like, what is this? How does it work? Help me. And you have been very helpful. And I now get many of the same questions that I asked you. And if there are any aspiring cookbook authors or co-authors out there, I'm happy to talk. I'm happy to really get into the nitty-gritty about numbers, percentages. I mean, it shouldn't be as opaque as it is. And I just don't know why it's so...
Well, it's a very...
It's very niche.
I was going to say special. It's a very niche thing. It's not something you read about. Thank you. You're very kind to mention it. That is how we first met. A mutual friend said, can you help my friend Jamie? You know, I always say when I did the first book I ever did, everybody was awful to me. I had to figure it out myself. And I've always, to this day, I mean, I get these emails from mm-hmm. strangers. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you said that because I think it's a little corny.
I mean, you should go talk to Andrew first because he's done literally 30 more books than me. But
she doesn't really want you to call. Call me. No. No, but don't you feel that it's like, it feels good to help younger
people? Oh, totally.
People get,
I mean, look,
you
there's,
could get really hosed on a bad deal.
There's plenty of cookbooks to go around. I don't feel like this is... I mean, it's a competitive space, sure,
yes.
but it's not like... I'm never afraid that there's not going to be another one.
Yeah, and also you can make big mistakes. You know, people don't know this, but just as an example, a lot of people do book proposals with people, and they have no, you know, the way you do it if you have an agent or if you've done mm-hmm. it or been around the block mm-hmm. is when you write the proposal, your deal for the proposal is also your deal to be the collaborator on the book.
Right.
And a lot of people write a proposal, they have no right to be the author of the book, and that gets messy, but you mm-hmm. have no rights. Mm-hmm. Like, even that, you mm-hmm. need someone to tell you that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is an appropriate sentiment to share on a show about chefs,
because yeah, I think
this is how a lot of culinary advice gets passed around.
Yeah. I also think for a chef, a proposal, you know, it's an out-of-pocket expense, but yes, it's worth it to invest in a writer, a recipe tester, a photographer. Even for the proposal stage, you don't want to go crazy, obviously, but it's sort of one of those, you got to spend money to make money, and it'll help you get a bigger advance in the end.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And good to see you back in New York.
Thank you.
I'll see you soon. Again, that was Los Angeles-based writer Jamie Feldmahr. We're skipping our usual mid-show break this week as I think about a more productive way to use that space. That's usually where I mention that our theme song and break music is by the band After School Special. So I did want to acknowledge that here. Please get their album Double Barrel, Single Entendre on iTunes. And please visit our website, andrewtalkstochefs.com, to check out our catalog of more than 100 shows. Visit the Tokeland blog I mentioned at the top of the show and get in touch with yours truly if there's anything on your mind. Okay, our next guest is Raquel Pelzel. I've only known Raquel a few years, but she's a real force in the cookbook world. She's been a freelance writer and collaborator, has authored her own books, and most recently published Umami Bomb. She's also the editorial director of cookbooks at Clarkson Potter. We talk about what it's like to be on the publisher side of things, as well as about umami and how she explores it in her book. Before we talk about your book, let's talk about your job.
Okay.
Can we do that?
Sure.
Is the title?
Which
have
one?
The one where you spend your days in an office.
Yes.
Is it editorial director? Is that accurate?
Yeah, editorial director of cookbooks.
At Clarkson Potter,
yeah.
An esteemed publishing house.
It's a big one.
What exactly is that job? That's a very non-descriptive, it sounds descriptive, but it's not.
Yeah, so.
That title.
Essentially, I mean, I have a list. I work with, you know, authors on their books that are coming out. I help them conceptualize what they might want to do next. I also work on list balance, work on, you know, looking at the what we have coming out each season as a whole, what we have holes in, what we, you know, might potentially be interested in. I'm always looking for new talent to bring in. I do have a lot of meetings, have a lot of lunches,
editors,
a lot of phone calls. Yeah, editors, but also just people who are like, I had this great phone call with this guy from who had left Food Network Digital, and he was like, yeah, I don't know what to do. I'm just kind of trying to figure out what to do next. And it was like a really nice informational kind of chit-chat.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, and by the way, you know, there's this guy who's done work with us, and he's amazing, and he really should have a book. And he told me about him, and so I signed him for a book because he is amazing. And, you know, he's awesome. His name is Rick Martinez. He does stuff for Bon App.
Okay.
He used to be an editor there, and now he's kind of like at large. And he just had his first piece run in the New York Times last week.
That's huge.
Yeah, and
that's
he's great. Amazing. So it's like, I love doing that. And also, you know, I feel like it's good to, you know, just have those conversations with even people just starting out in the business. So it's, you know, a lot of that.
You've spent years, as most of us, you and I and a lot of our mutual friends, as a freelance writer, as a cookbook author and collaborator. Mm-hmm. Now you're on the, you know, now you're up in the ivory tower. you're now a, you know, you're a decision maker now. What are the joys and what are the pains of being in that position?
Oh, wow. I mean, the joy is, of course, the joy is getting to work with authors. I mean, the joy is giving someone an opportunity to write a book that is meaningful to them and that I think will make a difference in people's everyday lives. I mean, that's the goal, right?
Right.
Is to publish books that they matter. And maybe they're not super intellectual books, you know, about the history of a cuisine, but they affect people's life. You know, their lives on the daily, you know, what they put on their table for their family, and they're making an investment in ingredients and their time and cleanup and all the rest of it. And, you know, when you have that one recipe that makes a difference and that your kids love and that it becomes a part of your family story.
Yeah.
So that's something that I love. Something that I don't love, I don't know. I mean, you know, Clarkson and Potter, we're a part of Penguin Random House. We're a big company. There's a lot of hoops to jump through sometimes to get something done. So yeah. That I'm not used to, because as a freelancer, if I needed to do something, I would just do it. You know, right. You just make it happen.
Yeah.
You're you know, you hustle it, or you're kind of savvy to get things done that you need to get done. And,
right.
You know, now sometimes I have to ask questions to 10 different people in 10 different departments.
Yes.
And, you know, that can take a while, and people are on vacation, and then you forget, and then the email gets lost, and then you have to dredge it back up, and, you know, all this stuff that comes with working in a big company.
Well, there's a reason a lot of us became writers, right? And part of it is incompatibility with everything you just said. I mean, I spent years doing all that before I was able to make a living as a writer.
Yeah.
When I was in the marketing business, and like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I mean, just hearing it, I'm like, I tense up.
Yeah.
I tense up.
Yeah. I mean, but the good thing is that, you know, we work pretty autonomously, and the other editors at Potter, I mean, we're a good group and it's fun. At the end of the day, you know, we all feel really proud of what we do, and to work for a company that is so forward thinking and gives back so much to the community, and, you know, in donations and, you know, charitable contributions and all of that feels really good.
Right.
So that helps make the corporate stuff seem okay.
So what I thought you were maybe going to say is, you know, you did say on the plus side, you know, working with people, working with, you know, writer, mm-hmm. okay. But I would think that saying no to, you got to say no to a lot of people. Or say it's been great to meet you,
but
let's keep the, or these euphemisms people have, let's keep the dialogue going, or I'll be interested to see what you do next.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, basically not being able to buy their book.
Right.
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 Is that hard?
Yeah. I mean, especially when it's a friend, you know, I've been doing this for so long that I, you know, you know a lot of people, and you want, like, I've wanted to work with a whole bunch of people that I've had to say no to just because, you know, I've had to really learn and understand what makes a book a Potter book versus a book from another house.
Yes.
And, you know, there's specific things that we look for in a book.
Yep.
And if this person could have the most amazing proposal, it could be such a beautiful story, the recipes could look incredible, but if we can't publish that book to the best of our abilities, we'll pass on it.
Yeah.
And someone else will...
It might
publish
be in their
wheelhouse. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think people realize. I mean, you referred a little while ago to the list. So the list is the books that are coming out in a given season.
Right.
Most publishing houses have some, not necessarily an exact number, but some ballpark number they want to hit each season.
Mm-hmm.
And then what word did you use? The balance?
Balancing to make sure that, you know, in fall 2020, we don't have 12 baking books coming out at the same time. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Or like... you know, 6 books by Italian-American chefs.
Right,
but they were from different regions, but they're all Italian-American.
Exactly.
Right, because you cannibalize your own stuff and it looks ridiculous, right? But I don't think what I think a lot of people don't even really realize is that much like, I guess the closest example, well, actually the closest example now would probably be like streaming services,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I was going to say like old movie studios, there were certain types of movies that were a 20th Century Fox movie,
mm-hmm.
and there were certain movies that were Paramount. These things changed over the years,
right?
But now you could say there's certain series that are like an HBO series. There's certain things that belong on Showtime.
Right,
you
or
know?
Netflix or
Hulu.
Netflix. Or,
yeah, and people kind of know. What,
yeah.
Maybe you can't, I'm sure those people who work at those places could.
Yeah.
But there are things that just stylistically, tonally
mm-hmm.
seem to... You know where you're going to look for that.
Right. And also, and personality-wise and, you know, an author's platform and all
but
of that
But that's
kind of
true
stuff.
Of publishing houses.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure
there's a type.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, I think there's certain things that we look for. I think there's sometimes there's an author who maybe doesn't check all the boxes, but we believe in the story so much, or we believe in what they want to do so much that we know we can create a story around that. You know, when we buy a book, at the same time, we're thinking about how we're going to sell the book.
Right.
So, you know, we have to present the book to the whole editorial team. And we present the book to so many people before we actually buy it. We're crafting this conversation of who's going to buy the book, who's going to care, how is it going to sell, where are we going to sell it?
Yes.
Because if we don't publish the book well and it doesn't sell, then we're not doing the author a very good service, yes, you know, for their brand, for their, you know. So we have those conversations all the time.
So, well, you said jobs before when I said your job. So one of your jobs is you're still a writer.
Yeah.
And you have a new book.
I do.
It's relatively new. It came out early September. It's called Umami Bomb. First of all, could you believe that title wasn't taken?
No, I looked it up
so
many times.
How did you get that title? That phrase has been out there
forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I thought of the idea and I was like, this has to have been done.
Right.
Like, this has to be out there. And it wasn't. And I kind of pinched myself and couldn't believe it. So finding
Googled
the title.
You Googled and re-Googled. Yeah.
You know, looked at the Pub Weekly and all that to see what's coming out and make sure that no one has the title.
Yeah.
Finding a title for a book is really hard.
Yeah.
It's one of my least favorite things to do because you're trying to find the perfect way to describe something that people will get in a second.
Yes.
Without you having to describe it, you know.
Well, I was going to say it can't be too literal, although in your case, it actually is, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it slightly isn't. But I always tell people you got to think poetry, not prose. Like the best titles, if you take all the words it would take to describe what you want to say literally, it'll be too long.
Right. Well, look at your book title. I mean, your book title is... it's
Chef's Drugs and Rock
and
Roll.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's literal, but yet you know exactly by... You know what it is by reading the title, but at the same time, it's really playful and it's fun. So with Umami Bomb, I kind of wanted to bring like the big savory flavors to vegetables and to have the book really represent how I cook at home, which is super vegetable forward. And I don't really eat meat so much anymore. I eat fish. I try to eat it less than I used to.
Yeah.
But I really try to be mostly kind of plant-based, although I don't like to paint a title onto myself. So it's a lot of things to have to say to describe a book,
right.
but I think at its core, Umami Bomb is about bringing really big flavors to vegetables to make your vegetables taste awesome, which is because I have two kids, it's really important to me to get, not only do my kids love eating vegetables, but when they have friends over, their friends eat vegetables and they often go home and the parents will then call me or text me and be like, Matthew can't stop talking about your Brussels sprouts and I'm trying to figure out why. And,
right.
You know, so I thought it would be cool to
umami.
Put together. Umami, add flavor.
Right. So can you, for people who, you know, the four people listening who don't know, how do you define umami?
I define umami as it's the fifth sense, right? It's the fifth sense of taste. It's savory. It's the savory quality that, you get essentially through the breakdown of protein into amino acids, if you want to get technical about it.
Uh-huh.
But it can happen in vegetables. It happens in meat. It happens, it happens when you take a food product and it's aged somehow, or it's fermented, or it's caramelized.
Right.
You know, you're changing the structure of the protein, and
yes,
as it breaks down into aminos, you get this umami element.
Yes,
which is somewhat indescribable, but I kind of like to say it's what makes you go in for a second bite. Like you eat it, and you're
like,
oh. Like this is way better than I thought it was going to be, and then
right,
and then you keep going in because it kind of like I'm kind of smiling as I say this
because
when I eat something that's really big in umami, like it gets into your cheeks, kind of like it gets into the sides
it's
of
addictive.
Your tongues, and
it's short term addictive.
Yeah,
it's what Nancy Silverton refers to as craveable.
There we go.
Same element, right? That same quality of like I want that.
I want that. I have to have
it. Or these kids who go back to their own homes and say, I want these Brussels sprouts that taste like that.
Yeah.
It seems like, no?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you want to create something that tastes better than you thought it would, better than you think it should.
Yes.
You know,
right,
that's really like you want to go in for three more bites.
Right.
You can't help yourself.
Right.
That's umami. And I kind of wonder if when those proteins break down, like if chemically something happens and it triggers something in our brain, like, serotonin or maybe
there's
some...
That is kind of addictive. Like, how do you say the type of pepper? You'll know this.
The type of... Oh, capsaicin? Capsaicin?
They say that those peppers have an addictive...
Right.
Is it an enzyme? I don't know.
I don't know.
There's something, though, that they say is...
It would be curious to see if there is
Like when people say, why do... Like when people eat really spicy food, why do they keep shoveling it in their mouth even when their mouth is on fire?
Right.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
There is
Must
something
have more.
That
there
like
is some
yeah,
kind of trigger.
It triggers something.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That would be cool to see if there's any kind of that would be interesting to see if that
Somebody
happens.
Should look into that.
Someone should.
Okay, so in the book you focus on
there's I think 8 umami chapters. There's 8 chapters.
Sorry.
There's one for every there's one chapter on miso, there's one chapter on soy, soy sauce. So I kind of divided it by ingredient.
Yes.
Different umami ingredients and then had fun playing around with them.
And you have how many recipes total?
75, mm-hmm. And there's a very mini fish chapter at the end of three recipes.
Okay.
I know, because, you know, to say that, and I mean, you know, I wrote about bacon. I wrote about the umami that you get in bacon and then how to mimic that in vegetables, because you can't talk about umami without talking about meat, because you do get a lot of umami when you eat meat and fish and, you know, like, say, fish sauce and...
Yeah.
And bacon's a perfect example,
yes.
Or chicken skin, chicken fat. You know,
yeah.
That's a great umami,
yes.
Umami ingredient. But how do you get that into vegetables when you don't want to tap meat protein, when you don't want to tap, you know, meat products?
And the answer is?
Well, I think the answer is layering flavor and then counting on these ingredients to give you that extra quality of craveability, as you say,
right.
To, you know, build that into the recipe.
Yes.
But, you know, when you add soy sauce to, say, tomato sauce, it doesn't make the tomato sauce taste weird. It doesn't make it taste like, you know, you should be eating it, I don't know, with chopsticks or something.
Right.
It's just adds a little bit of salty, a little caramelization. It gives it more backbone and more structure.
So you say, like, I was going to say like a baseline.
Yeah. It's fuller and richer, and it's kind of like, you know, I don't know, it's like listening to something on really bad speakers and then plugging in really expensive ones, and you have like round sound.
What did you learn working on the book? Did you learn anything? I mean, you had already been cooking like this, but what did anything deepen about your appreciation for this? Or,
you know, when working with vegetables, you really have to consider how you're going to make them, how you're going to build flavor, and how you're going to make them into something that doesn't just seem like a side dish, you know? So, you know, when people don't eat meat, you're still looking to get protein. You're still looking to, you know, feel happy and content after you eat something for dinner, right? And that's the main complaint when people, you know, try to go to a vegetarian diet or try to stop eating meat. It's like, well, I'm going to be hungry. How do you stay full? You know? And I think fullness can also be very psychological. And when you have something that is very thoughtfully considered as far as the flavor is concerned, I think that does give you a sense of contentment that translates to fullness, right? So, I mean, you're still eating like a decent portion of food, right? But because it just doesn't taste like broccoli that was, you know, roasted broccoli.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound super exciting. But, you know, add some parm or add, you know, soy or add, you know, some kind of like a miso dressing and, you know, make it a little interesting.
Yep.
And then it becomes all the more satisfying. So I think I was constantly trying to think of ways to, you know, take a sheet pan of vegetables and roast them, right?
Yes.
Because that's a workhorse. It's something that everyone relies on.
Yeah.
But how do I add that umami element that makes them so good that you just want to make them again and again?
Yeah.
And that makes them very satisfying.
Where does texture play into all this?
I mean, I always think about texture when I'm creating a recipe and building a dish, as far as umami is concerned.
Well, as far as these dishes and hitting the sort of these buttons you were just talking about.
Yeah.
I'll tell you where the question comes from. Amanda Cohen was on this show.
Oh, she's so great.
And we were talking, and she made this point. I hadn't really thought about it. How, you know, when you have a piece of meat, there's all these different textures, right? There's like fat and muscle and this and that, right? And then, like, most vegetables are actually unitextural.
Right.
Right? And so that's where the question came from.
Cool. So, crispy. That's a big one, right? Throwing something under the broiler. Crispy or crunchy can also come in the form of nuts or something that you sprinkle over it, sesame seeds, something like that. Where else does texture come in? I mean, I think that, you know, isn't that the beauty of the grain bowl? Like what's kind of taken over, you know, lunchtime. I mean, my office is in Midtown lunch. It's like, get your grain bowl.
Yeah.
But it's this beautiful combination of crunchy, creamy, you know, and textures too. It's like, or texture and flavor. So it's you have your crunchy, you have your creamy, your play, playfulness and temperature. You have the playfulness and flavor.
Yeah.
So I think you're always considering some kind of textural component.
Yeah.
So it doesn't taste monotonous.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Do you have favorites in the book?
Are
you
able
to pick favorites?
Yeah. One of my favorite favorites I do these waffles with aged cheese in them, like mm-hmm. I think I used an aged cheddar in the book, but you could do an aged Gouda. And it doesn't make the waffles cheesy because I don't use that much, but it gives them that umami thing.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, I serve them with maple syrup, and if you don't tell you that there's cheese in it, you wouldn't even know.
You
but
wouldn't necessarily
it's like,
get it was that.
But you eat them, and you're like, oh, these are really good. Like, there's something about it that's just a little bit special. And I do them thin, like Eggo style waffles. So
oh,
they get
cool.
really crispy,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
crispy and browned.
Yeah.
I love the cheapo waffle makers. $20 at like yeah. Bed Bath and Beyond.
And there's little enough cheese that they don't stick to the...
Yeah, no, they don't stick. It's great.
Yeah.
I love the waffles. I do this, I make like a Lapsang Souchong brew. So it's like a smoky tea, smoky black tea. And I make a brine out of it and I marinate tofu in it to give tofu the smoky umami element, which is really nice.
Cool.
That's a really fun one. And the grilled cheese is really good. I put miso butter on it and caramelized onions, and that's pretty awesome. Yeah, there's a lot of, and then there's this cake that I put soy sauce in the frosting, and it gives it this like semi-salty dulce de leche.
So it still reads like a dessert.
Oh, absolutely. It doesn't taste like soy sauce. It doesn't taste savory at all, but it has this salinity, and then this caramel component too, that it just elevates it. It just makes it a little more interesting than what you would expect.
Well, this has been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for talking about all
this.
Yeah,
totally.
The book again is Umami Bomb by Raquel Pelzel. It's been out for a while, so you can find it. Can we say anywhere books are sold?
Everywhere books are sold.
Everywhere books are sold. If it's not for you, get it for someone in your life who wants to eat their veggies and have them taste great. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, that was Raquel Pelzel, author of Umami Bomb and editorial director, cookbooks at Clarkson Potter. And our last guest of this week's show, but certainly not the least of our guests, is, like Paul Kahan, a returning guest, my old friend Rob Newton, first featured here about a year ago, who I got to know when he was chef and co-owner of the popular restaurants Seersucker, Nightingale 9, and Wilma Jean in Brooklyn, New York. He recently published his first book, Seeking the South, in which he smartly divides the American South up into 5 regions in an effort to make sense of its culinary heritage for readers. It's a fascinating read with recipes that remind me, and I'm sure will remind others who were lucky enough to be there, of the southern bent of Rob's food at Seersucker, where he first made a splash in New York several years ago. I should also mention that Rob and I met on the very day Seeking the South published, right before a speaking gig that he had booked in Brooklyn, so we had to improvise and conduct this interview near the bookstore where he was due to speak. We ended up at Brooklyn Social, which is a popular industry after-hours bar in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. It was probably the earliest either of us had ever been there. The sun was still out outside the windows, but the music was going like it does after midnight, so you'll hear a little of that in the background, but not too loudly to hear us talk. So here you go, my conversation with Rob Newton about his book, Seeking the South. Rob, congratulations. I didn't realize until we were just talking to the bartender here, this is your actual pub day.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this won't air for several weeks.
Thank you so much.
But yeah, congratulations. Glad to be sitting here with you on this momentous occasion.
Dude, I could talk to you forever. Every time we have these conversations, time flies and we look at each other and we're like, what the hell just happened?
I know. Well, we spent 20 minutes just trying to find a place to do the interview. So listen.
Well, that's my fault. I don't like mosquitoes. It was too hot. La, la, la.
It's whatever. I have this out of control optimism. So let's stay focused on the book because we did an interview just back in December, which I'm sure I'll have mentioned in the intro to the show. This book that for me at that time was strictly theoretical, you know, a thing that only existed in verbally, as you talked about it once in a while. Here it is. We're sitting here with it. I'm looking at it, Seeking the South. You are from the South. And this is your, I think, very unique on the South. It is. I remember when you first had this idea years ago, talking about dividing the South up into 5 regions, which I don't think I had ever heard anyone say. I think that this is your take on it.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of how, it's kind of how I see it. I think it is high time for Southern cuisine to be recognized a little more deeply. It's one of, if not the most important cuisines in America.
Yeah.
And I think it deserves that level of respect. And I think when you try to define a cuisine, you have to do things like this and promote the narrative and promote dialogue about it. And I think breaking it down into five subregions is a good move and a way to help achieve that goal.
Well, it for me is, I mean, I grew up in South Florida. I grew up in Coral Gables / Miami. That is geographically the South. That is not the South.
Yeah.
That's like the North.
I'm not going to enrage all your listeners.
That's
by
like the North, like kind of hopscotched over the area you're writing about. And then like,
yeah, the area of Florida that's included in my book is included in the Gulf Coast chapter, and it pretty much
the panhandle
skims right across the panhandle, over to Jacksonville.
Right, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as a kid, you drove north, like up toward Georgia, and all of a sudden, people had accents.
Yeah.
Which they did not have in Miami, wild, right? Except maybe they had Cuban accents, you know?
Right.
And lest anybody get upset about that, that's a pure fact.
This is a good book out there for somebody to write about Florida cuisine, all the other stuff, you know? So many cultural influences.
There are. I think Norman Van Aken's taken a stab at that probably a couple of times. Yeah. His take on that.
Yeah.
But let's, first of all, you were a little more restrained in what you just said. You said, you know, one of the most important American foods. But in the book, you actually say that you think it is the most important American food. And what I...
The
way I interpret that is the way some people talk about jazz. In that, you know, it used to be said of jazz. I don't know if this would be a true statement now because of all the new types of music that have come about in the last several decades. But people used to say jazz was the one true original American cuisine. And if I understand...
You mean music?
I mean music.
Yeah.
And if I take the way... When you make that statement in the book, I have a feeling you mean something akin to that. That Southern cuisine is something that was very much... I mean, yes, there are these influences that weave into it, but it's a style of food. There are dishes there that are a unique byproduct of the different factors that were woven together in the South. Some of them, as you take head on, are things that are painful history. You know, you do say some of this comes from people who were enslaved.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's those components are obviously sad and is a very dark period in our history. Stories like that and other immigration stories, there's not as many stories out there about Native Americans because they're the original indigenous inhabitants of the American South. But it's all those things combined that make Southern cuisine so rich and storied. And,
yeah.
And, you know, one of the... Probably the most important cuisine in America, yeah.
Say important, I mean... Well, why do you say important? What makes it important?
Because of its history, it's rich, it's deep, it's very troubled, historically, and then naturally, food is woven into that because
people bring their food with them.
People bring their food with them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know? A lot of the other threads, I mean, things that I've written about. People who know my career know, you know, I've written about stuff. A lot of the food that I've written about and a lot of the food people think about when they think about American cuisine, it's purely pleasure, right? Purely pleasure, purely entertainment, purely amusement for the palate and the eyes. This is actually cuisine that has, like we say, roots that go in many directions, some of them not, things that we're ashamed of, rightfully, as a nation, but the food survives, right?
Sure.
So I think what's interesting to me, as I started to say a minute ago, as somebody who grew up in Florida, lives in New York, the South to me is like, I have no real conception of it. You know, I read Southern authors. It just seems like a foreign land to me.
Sure.
But I think what was so shrewd, not in a calculated way, I guess I should just say smart, is that when you break it up into five regions, it makes it, no pun intended, more easily digestible to like a... adopted Yankee like me, who just kind of sees the South and its food as just this kind of murky, unknowable land, you know, that's almost like another country to me in my thinking and in my perception of it. But this makes it something, you know, that you can kind of, oh, okay, here's five regions. Each one has these traits, and it makes sense of it.
You're exactly the person I was writing it for because I dealt with that a lot at Seersucker. People
come to Southern food with a preconceived notion of, well, if there's not grits, then it's not Southern food. Or
gravy.
Everything has to have collard greens. Or why are there not hush puppies here?
Fried chicken.
What do you mean everything's not fried? Like, there are these,
yep,
these notions that people have based on stereotypes and perhaps Cracker Barrel. I don't know. that's what it is. And it is some of those things, the cuisine. But it's also so, so much more. And I wanted to explore that. And one way to get that point across, and also one of the ways that I approached menu writing at Seersucker was to break these things down into different regions, because it was and is very obvious to me that growing up in Northern Arkansas, I did not eat what a person growing up in Charleston would eat. And that's all of the South, but two totally different places.
Well, again, you know, you think regions, you name five. 30 years ago, it was a revelation in this country that there were 20 regions of Italy, right?
That was a big inspiration for me.
And
absolutely.
And, you know, when you talk about the way you just said, a lot of people define Southern food as these five sort of, you know, five or six sort of cues that they know. That would be like thinking that Italian food was nothing but spaghetti and meatballs, pizza, minestrone,
absolutely, soup.
Some of these things aren't even traditionally Italian, really. They're Italian-American.
That's what I wanted to do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. So why don't you take us through, what are the five regions? Just give me the executive summary of the five regions.
The Upper South,
mm-hmm,
includes the northern half of Arkansas, my home state, Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and a little bit into North Carolina, and a little bit into Virginia, where the mountains are, and what helps sort of define Appalachia.
Yeah.
The Deep South, which would be the lower part of Arkansas, almost all of Louisiana, except when you get down to the Gulf Coast part.
Yeah.
And then it just, that whole swath just proceeds east through Mississippi, Alabama, loops up to Georgia, until you get to the coast, which is low country.
Yep.
And that's pretty much coastal Georgia and South Carolina, obviously, and coming inland 70, 80 miles or so. Tiny little part of Florida there, but I don't really touch on too much cuisine of coastal Florida in the book. Gulf Coast is basically Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, a little bit of the panhandle, coming up to about I-10, which runs east to west along those southern states.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tidewater Coastal Plains is most of Virginia and most of North Carolina from the coast, running to the other side of those mountains I described in the upper,
yes,
south, where you come into the Piedmont, you come up near Asheville,
yep,
where it becomes mountainous and you sort of leave the feeling of ocean and more, mm-hmm, more mountain slash sometimes flat land behind.
Got it. So as you know, I remember when you lived in Brooklyn, periodically you loading up your car. We were going to do it together once. We never did.
We were going to do what?
Do one of these. You would take road trips.
Oh, yeah.
You did a lot of long road trips through the South. Is that how you started to... Was that how this book came together? It would seem to me that would be a logical outgrowth of actually traveling in a car, you know, over all of this terrain, seeing, like I just said, when I used to live in Florida and I would drive north at some point, there were all of a sudden southern accents, right?
Right.
Was that the kind of the beginnings of you being able to define these regions by seeing how the food that was on offer changed as you drove through these areas? Or how did you hit upon this structure?
I don't know. It just occurred to me. I think the seeds of this idea existed when I was planning Seersucker, and I'd worked as a private chef for a long time, as you know, and my boss had sent me to Italy to do some cooking and working and studying the wood-fired oven cookery a little bit. So I spent time over there, and I just started to realize the regional specificity, and I already knew that Italy wasn't one big thing, but I just saw how it was broken down, and I just felt really strongly that the South should have the same, people should have the same perspective about the South and Southern cuisine, and my ideas were already formulating that I wanted to do my own restaurant, and so I sort of used that notion sort of some guidelines about how I planned what Seersucker was going to be like and what the, I didn't break the menu down that way, but I took inspiration from that region. And I sort of looked at it that way because that's just how my brain works. Even when I approached like Vietnamese food and did mm-hmm. such a deep dive on that, that sort of has changed the way I cook. I look for regional authenticity and I find the ability to get creative as long as I stay within that region somewhat and have some respect for what I'm doing there. So when I would approach a dish like Carolina fish muddle, I could stay true to the dish and use the ingredients and then maybe use some fish that were, you know, from up here as opposed to something that you might only find in coastal Carolina. Mm-hmm. I'm just freestyling here, but for an idea like that. So as long as I stayed true in my approach
to the spirit of the original.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would just stay within that region for that idea. And then for a dish like if I was doing something from New Orleans, you know, I would just try to stay true to what's going on there.
Yeah.
And it just sort of evolved out of that. And I just felt like that was a good platform to build this book around.
So what's it been like for you to have it kind of see the light of day? I mean, it is sort of a, you know, you say in the book or in the introduction, you say you're a chef, not a historian. And then you point people to these like references, right?
Sure.
But this is it's not like a doorstopper of a book, but this is sort of an ambitious, I think it's kind of a gutsy thing to put out there. To kind of offer this structure that nobody's offered before. Well, because I think it's sticking your... I think you have a lot of respect in the community, generally, but I also within specifically, you know, chefs who operate in the Southern mode. But I do think anytime you're going to attempt to put a structure to something, to define something, to give a new kind of gloss to it, I think you are sticking your neck out a little because people might take exception to it or who is this guy kind of thing. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think, I don't know. Was it at all daunting to be putting this out into the world?
No. I think the who is this guy thing happened when I opened Seersucker because I've been a private chef for so long. And
then boom, you owned a restaurant.
I stuck my head up out of the sand and opened a restaurant with a really strong Southern perspective and a lot to say about Southern food.
In a neighborhood that was exploding.
in Brooklyn,
In Brooklyn, like, you know, a couple blocks from Prime Meats.
Sure.
You know, it was sure. like in a part of Brooklyn that all of a sudden was one of the two or three restaurants.
Yeah, it was
rows.
Very hot in 2010.
Yeah.
So I feel like I've already kind of been down that road, you know.
Right.
Can you make Southern food outside of the South, which I say in the book, I think is a silly notion. So I'm not too concerned about that. I think... I spent a lot of time thinking about how I wanted to divide it up, and it is my opinion. I'm not a cartographer. I'm not a historian, although I'm a bit of a history buff. It's just how I see it, and I think by and large, other people think that way about the South already.
Did anything in the process of writing the book change thoughts you had going into the book, or were you pretty much, like, had you already pretty much done all your research? You were pretty unshakable in terms of how these areas were going to break out.
Yeah, I really wanted the Gulf Coast and the Delta to be its own thing because the Delta is so important to feeding the Delta because of the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
But also historically, there's so much richness around the Delta. And I just couldn't find a way to make it all make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a way for that. I mean, that could be its own book probably. So that's why I just incorporate the Delta into the Deep South, and that's okay. This mm-hmm. totally works out fine. So that was an area that I really struggled with. I didn't really struggle with the other regions too much. They kind of define themselves, really,
yeah.
in my opinion. Other people might quabble with that, but whatever, that's
right.
okay.
But you haven't heard from anybody yet. No one's... no. You haven't got any...
No.
Yeah.
Do you think I will?
No, I really don't.
I hadn't even thought about that.
I think it's so well argued that I really don't see it being... No, I was just curious. Yeah. I would be, you know, the way... This is me, right? Anytime I'm trying to get my head around something and put structure to it, even though I do probably more research than most people I know would do because I'm a little compulsive, not because other people are lazy, because I'm compulsive and I over-research, is I'm always afraid someone's going to tell me I was wrong. Like, that's just a fear I have. But it's irrational.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
I guess what I'm saying is
I might be wrong.
I'm projecting.
It's just the way I see it.
I'm projecting. I'm projecting.
It's like I would encourage them to write a book. It's not an easy task.
So what?
I don't need to tell you.
What about this part of it? You're in New York. You're back in your old stomping grounds. I know you did another interview today. You got another interview, some other interviews later in the week that we're sitting here. Are you enjoying that part of it?
Being back in my old neighborhood?
Well, no, being back, but also the promotion part.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, it's fun to talk about something that you worked on for practically 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just getting started, but as of right now, yeah, I'm really enjoying it.
Well, the book is Seeking the South. The author is Rob Newton. It's great to see you again.
Thanks for having me, man. I always love doing these shows.
Always. And if you're out there, I would say, what do we say, Rob? I think chefs and non-chefs. I think it's a book written for civilians. It's not at all. You are a professional chef, but I think this is a book written for anybody really who wants to cook this food or understand it.
Totally. And you asked me a question earlier about what it changed or what did I learn or something like that. I would two little quick anecdotes about that. One is I sucked at writing recipes, like a lot of chefs, but I got a lot better at it really quickly.
Yeah.
Jamie, my co-writer, really helped me with that.
Yep.
Two, I had the misguided notion that my food was just kind of simple and seasonal and, and you know, just really, I mean, it is approachable, but when I started writing these recipes, I realized that I use a lot of
chefy stuff.
Not even chefy stuff. I don't have any like circulator or anything like that going on here, but I have a very big pantry because I draw a lot of inspiration from a lot of different parts of the world. So that was two. And three, what I tried to do is I had a fictitious character that I was always writing for who was like part my mom and part like maybe a homemaker who likes to cook or just a person who likes to
hobbyist cook
in general. Yeah. So I really tried to keep her in mind. She was from Nebraska in my mind for whatever reason.
That's okay.
And I tried to keep her in mind when I was writing this because I wanted her to be able to go to a store and find most of these ingredients. Like, she's not going to be able to find sorghum, probably. Other little weird things that you can easily get on Amazon.
Yes.
But I tried to keep her in mind, and hopefully that comes across, and people find the recipes doable and approachable.
Yeah,
and
I think they will.
Have some fun with it.
Yeah, I believe they will. I haven't cooked from it yet. I just got it, but having read through it, I believe that mission accomplished.
Thank you.
All right. All the best with it, Rob. Great to see you. And next time you're in New York, you know, maybe we'll have you back. You'll be one of our regulars.
I would love to be a regular, and you've been a good friend of me for a long time. And to be completely honest, I wouldn't probably have done this book had I not known you. And
what?
You introduced me to David. That's 100% true.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about our mutual agent.
Yeah. So thank you for that.
Well, that means
you're,
a lot. Thank
you in part helped make this happen. So I appreciate it. And I appreciate your friendship.
That's sweet of you to say. Thank you. Yeah. Right back at you.
Cheers, man.
And that's our show for this week. I hope you found it interesting. Thank you to all of our guests, Rob Newton, Raquel Pelzel, Jamie Feldmar, and Paul Kahan. If you want more information on them or their books, links to all of that is available on the episode page for this show on AndrewTalksToChefs.com. Please subscribe to Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's free on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And please follow us on social media at Chef Podcast is the handle for show postings and updates. And if you like what you just heard, please tell any friends you think would feel the same. We would really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our engineer, David Tatasciore, for splicing these things together. And thanks to all of you out there in podcast land for listening. See you back here soon with another new show.